Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Genocide Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host today, Jeff Bachman. Thank you all for listening. Today, we will be talking to Dr. Eyal Meiraz about his very new book, Reluctant Interveners, America's Failed Responses to Genocide from Bosnia to Darfur, published on November 15th by Rutgers University Press. This book was really of special interest to me because my own research on UN Security Council recognition of genocide or really general lack thereof, and my research into the relationship between the U.S. and genocide. So I'm looking forward to discussing America's failed response to genocide with our guest on today's show. Eyal Meiraz, welcome to the show. Eyal, I wonder if you could begin the interview by telling us a bit about yourself.
Sure. Thanks, Jeff, for inviting me. I grew up on a kibbutz in Israel, and I guess was educated in Israel. Worked as a farmer and moved from there to the army, as all Israelis do, and was a captain in counterterrorism intelligence. Then left the army, went traveling around the world for 5 years, including a 30,000-mile trip around the U.S., and then ended up in Egypt. Worked for 5 years in aviation security and counterterrorism in Cairo Airport. And 20 years ago, found myself in Australia, where I did my master's, PhD, and now teaching at Sydney Uni.
It's an interesting pathway. So what are your, how did you become interested in studying genocide? And do you have any mentors or peers that you work closely with?
Yes. actually, there's a bit of a story there as well. In 2005, I was a website developer in Alice Springs in the middle of Australia and visited my family in Israel. I was listening intently to a radio coverage of a Jewish extremist who went into an Israeli-Arab village and shot three innocent citizens. But after 10 minutes on the radio, the announcer said, "We have to stop this special coverage because there is this soft music program on the radio and our listeners would be very disappointed if we stop the coverage and miss out on the music." And I got so angry because if it would have been the other way around, an Arab would have killed Israelis, no one would have dared doing that. So there and there, I sat down and I said, I've got to study something that has to do with human rights violations. Found the course on Peace and Conflict Studies, a master's course, and that led me to the PhD. But because as an Israeli living in Australia, it's a bit hard to work on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict because Israelis then tell you, oh, it's very easy for you to be far away, safe and healthy and write about or research the conflict. I was really drawn to genocide because my stepdad is a well-regarded genocide scholar, Professor Yehuda Bauer, a scholar of the Holocaust. And he's an inspiration as well as linking to your other question about mentoring. He's been my mentor for a long time.
Wow. I did not know that he was, you said your stepfather, is that correct?
Yeah.
Yeah, I did not know that. Interesting background. So with that, and, you know, we'll get into the book some more, but it just made me think of another question. So taking all this background, why did you choose to focus on the United States and its relationship with genocide?
Okay, that leads to my second inspiration for the book, which is Professor Eric Creeves. Many of you have probably heard his name, a professor of English who spent the last 20 years as a one-man army fighting for the rights of first the South Sudanese and then the Darfuri people. And when I was doing my master's, I started reading his very sharp analysis. It used to be said that even at the State Department, they'd read first what Eric has written about Darfur and only then go and read what the CIA was writing. So I was so impressed by his life story, the challenges that he was facing personally, and at the same time, unceasingly working for the Sudanese people, that he was my inspiration for focusing on this topic.
Thank you. And so that, I guess, leads into a bigger question, which is, how did you come to write this particular book? What motivated the study, and how does it connect to previous scholarship on this topic?
Yes. Well, the question I started off with was, why do governments allow, and I was initially looking at the international level, why do governments allow mass atrocities and the killing of, you know, sometimes hundreds of thousands of people go without a strong international response? So that's how I started off. And then very soon after, I realized that the answers were pretty straightforward. You know, governments how take, you know, the hard interest that they take into account when making decisions about foreign policies and so on. But the question that I could not answer was, where are we as citizens, where, the public, in allowing our governments to get away with bystanding to genocide? So that led into the research that led to the book. And the focus on the U.S. was because the U.S. was, first of all, you know, one of the superpowers, I guess, but also because in the case of the U.S., the as a self-appointed champion of human rights, their rhetoric, the moralizing rhetoric on genocide, on human rights violation is quite strong, but the actions are often quite weak. And that gap was really of concern to me. In terms of linking to the existing scholarship, it was also interesting because since, I guess, to around 2002, when Samantha Power published her award-winning book, America, A Problem from Hell, nobody has written a full, except for you, I think, just very recently, no one has addressed the question of U.S. Foreign policy on genocide. And I think possibly nobody dared trying to, you know, compete with Samantha Power. But I found important gaps, especially because of what had happened in Darfur, because Power and two other authors that wrote their books at about the same time, Kenneth Campbell and Peter Ronayan, wrote their books shortly before Darfur had happened. And I think Darfur has floated a lot of important questions that were not addressed in their book. So that was the reason why I found this gap and was really interested to explore. The other point was that over the last, I don't know, certainly 10 years, we see what I see as a paradigmic shift in the relationship between a mass opinion and an elite opinion, and that especially in today's world with nationalist populism coming into the picture, I was feeling that there is an unaddressed opportunity to look more closely at what the public thinks about these issues of foreign policies, I guess, on certainly on mass atrocities, because for a long time, scholars have said, oh, we focus on the international settings, or they say states are not built or designed to focus on moral imperatives. And therefore, NGOs were left alone in the campaign to try and get publics, you know, 5 or 7 billion people around the globe to take active part in what we all see as genocide scholars as a huge omission on the part of the international community. So that was another big incentive for me.
Since you brought up Smith, however, could you talk a little bit about where your research converged with and where it diverged from her own findings?
Sorry, whose findings?
Samantha Power, specifically, you know, on the question of political leadership, you know.
Yeah, sure. Well, Samantha Power did a great job and very hard to, augment things that she did cover in great detail. However, two things I found that were a bit problematic. One was her focus was mainly on omission. And as a result, and possibly on her part inadvertently, the discourse about especially U.S. foreign policy relationship with genocide has been focused much more on omission than on anything else. And as a result, a lot of other genocides were left to the sidelines because we got so used to thinking about U.S. foreign policy on genocide in that respect. I thought, there has been quite a bit of scholarship since on indigenous genocides and so on, but I thought in terms of the U.S. policy that needed to be addressed much, much more seriously. The other point that I was concerned about was that, is worth further research, was that one of Samantha Power's conclusions was that genocide was lost in the domestic sphere, and I wanted to examine that following Darfur, which was, again, the first time that the U.S. government or any government issued an official genocide determination on a still ongoing genocide. And I was wondering how do the domestic dynamics in the U.S. compared with the international dynamic and the eventual international inaction and leaving the Darfuri people to their grim consequences of the genocide.
Related to all that, you know, there's, you know, this disconnect, excuse me, between rhetoric and policy actions. I definitely want to get more into the Darfur case, but just to take a couple of steps back for the moment, why did you choose to focus on the public and on its relationship with the public opinion, the media, and policy, and sort of the cascade and how, you know, information sort of flows from the executive down and also back up? And then also, why isn't the public more actively involved?
Sure. That's really the crux of my research and the greatest, significance I see in the book, because we are so used to, again, discounting the public that we don't really ask ourselves in as researcher in greater detail what is particular to the issue of genocide in relation to public inaction. So when you look at opinion polls, for example, the last 30 years, consistently, most Americans support stronger action on U.S. On the part of U.S. foreign policy in stopping or preventing genocide. And that, for me, was contrasting sharply with the fact that when the U.S., international, but let's talk about the U.S., when U.S. governments avoided acting on genocide, there was what Samantha Power called society-wide silence in the U.S. in the face of this inaction. So what I wanted to see was how do you reconcile beyond the simplistic explanations, this gap between strong support in opinion polls and acquiescence to inaction? And I saw that both at the level of the official America, in terms of at times strong moralizing rhetoric by presidents, by governments, or by administrations, compared to often inaction in the face of genocide, and at the same time with the public on, again, as I said, strong support to U.S. action, and at the same time acquiescence to inaction. So I wanted to examine and explore these relationships between the public and executive branch. And of course, when you talk about that, it's all about, or much of it is about, the flow of information up and down this relationship, and the media is the conduit of that information both ways, from the official America to the public, and from the public to official America, because my argument is that for officials to interpret what the public thinks about a particular action or inaction is something that they learn mostly from the flow of the information through the media. So obviously this relationship of public or opinion, policy, and the media was at the heart of my research.
And what did you find in sort of the cascade down from the presidency? What did you find in terms of the actual use of the term by U.S. presidents in the timeline that you looked at? I mean, I know that there was sort of they used it sometimes, but oftentimes it wasn't used to talk about a specific genocide, or it was used ex post facto. So yeah, you want to talk a little bit about what you found from the presidency?
Yes, sure. It's become very famous that on cases such as Rwanda, the reluctance by the first Bush and the Clinton administration, Bush was in relation to Bosnia, but the Clinton administration to use the genocide word was pointed to as an example of the fear of using the genocide label and what that would how would that affect policies and how would that affect public support for action. But beyond that, I wanted to look much more closely at, the last, 70 years, and how did presidents used or avoided the terminology, and what were the both the motivations for doing that, but also the effects on policies. And I found some interesting things. For example, for a long time, the word was not at all used by presidents. And if it was used, it was mostly in benign context around the Genocide Convention and, the 40 years that it took for the U.S. to ratify the convention. So here and there, discussions about that. But only, I guess, since the 70s, American presidents started using it more closely. And I was really concerned because if you look at the literature on the effects of the genocide label, there's a lot of assumptions there by genocide scholars, but there was not strong evidence to support those assumptions. David Sheffer in 2006 raised the question about replacing the word or augmenting the word genocide with a broader terminology of mass atrocity crimes. And for a brief time, there was a big discussion about what are the consequences of the word. But again, it was left mainly at the level of assumption. So I wanted to dive into that. And my assumption was that when the executive branch or the administrations are interested to lead the public towards some kind of intervention, as it happened eventually in Bosnia or certainly in Kosovo, then they'd be using the word. And in other cases where they want support for inaction, they'd be avoiding the word. And I found there's a lot of details about that in the book, but I found some interesting things that in some cases supported the consensus or what these assumptions, but in other situations quite negated those assumptions. And Darfur was a great it's hard to say great for such a terrible tragedy, but it was an important case study to explore that question because it was the first time that the word was used officially by the U.S.
Yeah, and so the case of Darfur, talking about sort of public activism and the public opinion, as a case that was referred to as genocide, as we just discussed, by the Bush administration, and when that included a pretty large activist movement, what did you find in your research on Darfur, and did it surprise you at all?
Sorry, what did I find in the research about?
About Darfur, yeah, in this sort of engagement with the public and the presidency or the executive. And did you find anything surprising in that research compared to other cases?
Yes, I found, on one hand, I found, a substantial change from the past. American presidents consistently avoided using the terminology. And here we see suddenly in Darfur, an official determination. So I wanted to, pursue the evolution of the use of the terminology from 2003 into 2004, and from ethnic cleansing into the use of genocide. What motivated what? What preceded what? And there were certainly quite a significant, if you like, a historical evolution to trace within those a bit more over a year. I'd say that in Darfur, it seemed like the U.S. policy was, let's make sure first that even if we use the terminology, which was, pressure, external pressure by domestic pressures, by NGOs and the public and the media to call Darfur genocide, first of all, let's make sure that even if we use the terminology, we are not locking ourselves into a serious responsibility to act very significantly on Darfur. And that was encapsulated in repeated discourse by Colin Powell to make sure that even if we use the word, the U.S. is already doing all it can and it's not going to make a difference. But on the other hand, and I see that within the State Department, there was a strong desire to try to influence mainly the international community to upscale its involvement and the pressure on the Sudanese government to stop the mass killings in Darfur. And there were these thoughts that by first exploring and researching the idea that Darfur was a case of genocide and then making that official determination, that would lead to a significant change in the international attitude. The fact was that eventually that wasn't enough. Even when a strong superpower such as the U.S. is making an official determination of genocide, that did not translate at the international level into significant action. And so my conclusion was that, at least in the case of Darfur, the genocide was not dealt with not because of domestic U.S. policies, but because of international dynamics.
Yes. So with all that, and
if I can add just one more point, or just in response to the same question, I guess, is that so I was saying that there was a desire to by the U.S. government to try to increase the international action on Darfur, but at the same time, a strong motivator was to deal with these domestic pressures that were also coming from the evangelist community and others that are, the core support for the Bush administration. So there was a need to alleviate those domestic pressures. And so that was another strong reason for the high-level U.S. Involvement with Darfur. But at all times, these efforts to try and push for stronger action on Darfur were still constrained by self-imposed view of the constraints. And some of these constraints were self-imposed by the U.S. itself. So effectively, at the end of the day, what had happened is what once the U.S. failed to elicit the international action and the genocide, I guess, toward into the end of 2004 and the beginning of 2005 continued, then the U.S. effectively left the fate of the Darfuri people in the hands of the same government, same Sudanese government that they themselves called a genocidary government. So at the end of the day, the executive branch did fail in its mission.
So responding without responding, in a way, I think. If you take the case of Rwanda, where the United States actively avoided using the term until June, and then we look at the early use of the term in the case of Darfur, do you think this has any impact on the power of the term genocide? Do you think it's retained its significance that was attached to it when it was first developed, or has it lost some of that impact?
Another good question. In the book, I spend quite a bit of work on on the relationship between Rwanda and Bosnia and the use of the terminology or the avoidance on terminology, and how did that either accord or contradicted the U.S. action during, you know, the 3 months of the Rwanda and the 3.5 years of Bosnia. And I, one of the conclusions made by a lot of advocates following Rwanda that was that, or the assumptions was that if they'd managed to get the U.S. to use the terminology, the genocide terminology earlier, things would have been different in terms of U.S. intervention, international intervention. So when Darfur happened, the efforts were all geared towards forcing the U.S. to admit officially that Darfur was a case of genocide. And I think that the ability of the U.S. to say or to actually issue the official genocide determination and at the same time be able to get away with inaction or relative inaction was kind of led to the understanding that a genocide determination can, at least in that case, could be used not as a call for action, but as a substitute for one.
Sort of jumping forward some, and then we will maybe, you know, we'll end up taking a couple steps back. But on the, you know, this, the power of the term genocide, there's been some recent research around whether, you know, mass atrocity crimes should be as a more useful term as an umbrella for genocide, crimes against humanity, war crimes, and ethnic cleansing. Do you think it's important that we maintain the use of genocide to describe things that fit within, you know, the legal or even scholarly definitions, or does mass atrocities have greater utility for policy purposes and responses?
Yes, another good question, which is, I guess, at the heart of my research. I mean, David Sheffer made some convincing arguments in favor of the use or the use of the terminology not only for the legal purposes but also for political purposes and in terms of how things or events are represented in the media. So I guess what I set out to find out, or one of the things I set out to find out, was how valuable is the genocide terminology and what are both the advantages and the disadvantages of using that. And it is a bit difficult in many cases to disassociate or to disengage the effects of the genocide label from effects of other either recurring or case specific challenges to action. But my conclusions were that, and it's only, I think, partial conclusion, I think more research is needed, was that while the broader terminology of atrocity crime goes a certain way to addressing some of the challenges of the terminology, and I may say a few words about these challenges, it also does not fully capable of harnessing the clout that Lemkin and others have instilled or embedded in the terminology of genocide. So I think I'm still out in terms of what exactly in what ways should we make best use of the terminology. I'm thinking maybe something like, I don't know, genocidal massacres or something that does not pressures government to the extent that a genocide determination does, because governments, and especially in the case of the U.S., are afraid to use the genocide label because they're afraid that if they took action and then wanted to retreat because of, you know, changed dynamics or circumstances, then it'll be much harder for them if they've already used the terminology of genocide. So in my research, I looked at 18 different recurring challenges to international action, and found that out of these 18, only 2 were specific to cases of genocide. So I found a lot more similarities between mass atrocities that were non-genocidal and genocidal mass atrocities in terms of these challenges, then I found things that were specific only to genocide. So I think I embrace the use of the terminology of mass atrocity crimes, but I am not fully committed or happy to let go of the terminology of genocide.
Thank you. I think it's important also. I asked that question by students before, just about the use of the term genocide and whether it raises any sort of increased ethical implications compared to other terminology. And yeah, I agree with you. I think that was a good answer that I should remind myself when I get asked that again. So jumping back to the role of the United States again, you talked a little bit about American exceptionalism and other things in your book about the United States and its relation with genocide. So I wonder, how is the United States different from other nations in terms of its relationship with genocide? How does the idea of American exceptionalism fit into that picture? And what about presidential leadership or lack thereof?
Okay, three questions. I'll try to remember. You remind me if I forgot anything. But first of all, I might start from the end because that's the easiest. In my research, I looked at the relationship between political leadership, and I focused mainly on presidential leadership and responses to mass atrocities. And I think there's a huge importance to the adoption of a political leadership to leading U.S. Foreign policy in a positive direction in terms of strong action on genocide, and vice versa. Often when we fail to act either as the U.S. or even the international community, it has much to do with the absence of strong political leadership. And that political leadership can be political leadership within the opposition to governments. And so I would say that even in the case of Darfur, when Colin Powell, Secretary of State, a very high-level official, is taking on himself to advance the case for Darfur, it wouldn't have been as strong as if President Bush had taken up that task. And maybe part of the reason why as late as July 2004, only 14% of the American population knew some or much about Darfur had to do with this lack of strong political leadership that can advance action not only within the administration, across the agencies and so on, but also to the domestic public, and of course internationally as well. So in terms of political leadership, that's a critical point for me based on my findings. In terms of American exceptionalism, yes, I think that links well with the question about differences between the U.S. and the and other countries. Two of the three endorsements that I got from the for the book cover from prominent genocide scholars, Ed Luck and Andrea Bartoli, used the word sober about my research, and I was a bit concerned because as an outsider to the U.S., I was wondering how do American scholars how would they perceive my research, because I hammer the U.S. foreign policy quite powerfully and have some strong words for public involvement as well. But I think the sober comes with balance, because at the same time, while I think the U.S., with its strong rhetoric and weak action is, should be looked at and certainly condemned when the time is right, I think there's a tendency around the world to very easily blame the U.S. for things that other countries are at least as guilty of, and in the case of Darfur, even guiltier of. So I think the U.S. Is coming out quite clearly as a country, as a strong power that could do more, and that speaks or uses a stronger moralizing discourse than other countries. But I think that the malady is international. Everyone and many other governments, or most other governments, I would even say, are as guilty as the U.S. in terms of inaction and bystanding to genocide. Now, when it comes to the public, I think that the significance and the level of significance of the use of the terminology of genocide in dominant American culture might be stronger than in many other countries. So that was another reason why I chose to look at the U.S. But again, we don't see, mass protests in the U.K. or in the developing world against the government inaction on Darfur, for example. So I think that we need to take things into perspective. I think the U.S. has especially over the 1990s and even before in the 80s, has abused the terminology of a humanitarian intervention for self-interest purposes, and that colored a lot of what the U.S. was doing overseas, a lot of the U.S. foreign policies in quite negative colors to wide publics around the world. So it's very easy nowadays to hammer U.S. foreign policy because of these failed actions or I'd say even disingenuousness on the part of the U.S. But again, we need to look at it more internationally. And when we look at it internationally, then I'd say that not many other countries are doing better.
Thank you. You mentioned my book earlier. Another genocide scholar critiqued it for its Marxist, quote unquote Marxist analysis of U.S. foreign policy. And the book certainly had a specific thing in mind with the book, and I did not focus as much on sort of the international politics that also influence U.S. foreign policy and decisions. But I am a U.S. citizen, and so I wonder, what role, I guess, do U.S. citizens have in sort of making the U.S., the exceptionalist rhetoric, sort of match the actions that are taken? And maybe this comes to some of the findings in your book. And I know I had a question I was going to save for later, but I guess it comes back to this. Is there reason for optimism? What can we do to make that rhetoric a reality?
Yeah, you're right. This question is at the heart of my research because, as I mentioned before, there's 5 billion adult people around the world that don't have as much say about policies that are either make or break international intervention to, prevent the killing of hundreds of thousands and overall millions of people. So certainly there should be more research focused on the role of the citizenry as well as why don't we do as much as we should? And there's plenty of research. Some of it is easily attributable to specifically to cases of mass atrocities. Other is more generalized. But this is something very important to look at because NGOs are left to try and harness people to their causes, and I don't think research does enough to help support those efforts. So if we look at why do Americans and likely others don't do more, then certainly we are as private citizens we are so engrossed in our daily challenges that we are left with relatively little time and motivation to act on little known or little understood far away humanitarian events or tragedies in the other side of the world. We have a limited ability to identify with the people and therefore to empathize with them. The media is often sending the information or still even today with social media, we're still getting at least Americans are most of their information about these events from mainstream media. And the mainstream media is to an extent, getting a lot of their information in turn from official sources. So governments, again, administrations in the case of the U.S. have a lot of leverage in how they frame the information that they discharge to the media and to the public in terms of what is that conflict about, who is responsible, what are the alternative policy options that we can take, what can we do and what can't we do. And so what I found in my research was that it is very easy to convince the public that that there's not much that they as citizens can do, or that even their countries, their governments cannot do, because so much of their knowledge is coming from information that is framed purposefully for that purpose. So American governments or administrations have become really adept at influencing or managing the public, if you like, based on a combination of this framed information, half measure actions, and by half measure actions, I mean actions that seem to be doing something, but which they already know is not going to make a difference. And I'll give in a minute an example to that, or maybe I'll give it now. For example, if you remember, I think it was in 2015, there was a lot of noise in the U.S. following the discovery of use of chemical weapons in Syria, and so there was a pressure on the governments to do more. And then the Trump administration launched 59 Tomahawk missiles and blew up a couple of sheds in a Syrian airport that from where allegedly the chemical attacks came about. And very soon after, the feeling among the U.S. public and certainly the coverage and so on was, we acted, we did something. And what can the blowing up of two sheds in a Syrian airport base can do to stop the, massacres of hundreds of thousands of Syrians is of course ridiculous. But the idea is to alleviate the consciousness of the people, knowing that we did something. And that's what I mean by an example of half measure actions. And a third element is to use moralizing rhetoric officially. By governments that are showing or pretending that we care, but they are targeted very delicately not to impose on us responsibilities for action more than we are willing to take upon ourselves. So that's the three ways of managing, if you like, the public that has been in my research. I found that the American administrations, both Republican and Democrat, have been using.
Yeah, so this seems to complicate things, or it makes it complex for the public, whether it's not wanting to intervene or intervening in a way that says we did something, even if it's not really especially effective. And then there's also cases where you mentioned that intervention in the past has been abused, and so I wonder if you have any thoughts on how the U.S. public can differentiate between, the use of political leadership in a way that seeks to suppress any sort of ideas about, the United States getting proactively involved versus cases where political leadership is used to gain support for something that might not actually be in the best interests of the people on the ground in a conflict, let's say. You have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think it's an excellent question, and I certainly have some thoughts about it. I think that part of the problem is that when we talk about humanitarian intervention, we have this idea that humanitarian intervention is nothing short of a full-scale military action. And in some cases, in extreme cases, that may be so when tens of thousands or when up to 10,000 people get killed in Rwanda per day, then there's not much time to try out non-military action that is often, it takes long to even realize if it's working or not. So there are extreme cases where I would embrace, strong and fast military action. And there's a contradiction there, because if we're talking about, launching a military action by the UN to increase the legitimacy, which is such an important thing, then it takes anywhere from 3 to 10 months to put together a force. So fast military action often can be done only by states, and then you had the challenges with the legitimacy of that action, especially because in the past, as you say, there was so much abuse of humanitarian intervention ideas for self-interest concerns. So I think that's an important point to take into account. But having said that, I think that a humanitarian intervention is and should convey a lot more than a full-scale military action, whether partial coercive actions or even more creative ways of using completely non-military actions that don't involve the negative side effects and consequences of inevitable ones for military action. So I think we kind of left it as a given that that not much can be done, for example, at the Security Council pressuring governments to do more. For example, if you look at Darfur, then without support from Russia and China, the Sudanese would not have continued doing the genocide. And then the question is, how does the U.S. or how does the international community yield stronger pressure on such powers as China and Russia? So I think there's a lot more room for action. And I think in some cases, the failures to act and the allowing of genocide and other mass atrocities was the consequences of lack of commitment by governments to some non-military actions that, if they would have persisted and been more proactive and active in engaging in them, would have stopped or would have changed the calculations of either genocidaries, perpetrators, or even the government, other governments who support them. And would have made a big difference. So I'm with you on the fact that we need to be very cautious when it comes to military actions. I think if we're going back to the public, then for the public, the fear of casualties is also a very strong deterrent to action. And so when you cast it as all or nothing, then there's a lot less support by the public for interventions. The last thing to say is that Prevention. That's always the solution to intervention, because if you prevent, then you wouldn't need to intervene. And there's not enough support. There's not enough public support. There are not enough resources, either at the national level, but also certainly international level to prevent. And that's where the main efforts should be taken to preventative action.
You know, you said about Russia and China and Dan, and I couldn't help but think about the U.S.-Russia. I couldn't help but think, you know, the executive has not yet recognized Armenian genocide, and because of its relationship with Turkey. And coming back to that, it just makes me think, you know, how much leverage does the United States have, and how willing is it to wield it from one situation to another? I don't know if you want to comment on any of that, but I'll ask you one other question, then you can address either if you wish. Thinking also about military intervention, did you consider the Libya case at all when you were thinking about the cases for your book?
Sorry, which case?
The Libya case with the intervention in 2011.
Well, I focused most of the research up to 2004. But I do, mention Libya in the sense that Libya was an example where international action was very fast, and I think it was a consequence of an accord. And often interventions are an accord between moral, imperatives, whether accurate or not, leave it for now. But moral imperatives, self-interests of governments, and legitimacy. And I think in the case of Libya, the critical component was that there was a legitimacy given by the by the Arab League, by Muslim states that supported the action. And so this relationship between legitimacy, moral imperatives, legal imperatives, and political considerations is a fascinating one to pursue. Of course, what had happened in Libya in the aftermath of the initial intervention, extending the campaign to a change of government, and the devastating consequences that led to inaction in Syria because of that precedence of Libya was very detrimental, and both, I guess, to that and to the standing of the R2P, the responsibility to protect doctrine that led to the intervention in Libya. You had another question about...
It was just about wielding or not wielding leverage or pressure on like China and Russia, but then not Turkey and the Armenian genocide.
Yeah, yeah. Look, I think that's the unanimous decision by Congress on calling the Armenian genocide a genocide after so many decades is certainly or almost 100 years is certainly a clear example of how political considerations have such a strong influence on decisions in that area. But I think that. And I'm working with a group called the Genocide GPA Net, the Genocide Prevention Advisory Network. We advise governments on mass atrocity prevention, and so I've had over the years some insights into looking at the inside of governments and diplomacy and these people that are diplomats and working within bureaucracies. Where are they? What can they do? Why are they doing things and why they're not doing things? So I think that there is a lot more room to work from within the system. And I think that the scholars should pay a lot closer attention and put a lot more effort into supporting those, often mid-level bureaucrats that are very good people that are trying to influence their governments into more conscientious and more, preventative or into more preventative policies that we are, as researchers, could do a lot more about. So I think, the same would apply for the US, but across the board.
Thank you. I think that's a good optimistic note on the things can change and things can improve. So I want to ask you two final questions to wrap things up. So first, what were you most surprised by in your findings? And then you can follow that with who's this book for? Who's the audience? Who do you want to read this book?
Okay, maybe I'll start from the second one. When you write a book, you have a big problem when you try to reconcile what you're writing and how you write and what to include in the book based on the target audiences. And obviously, you want as many types of audiences. I try to write the book for a wide range of audiences, from certainly genocide scholars, media people, policymakers, NGOs, but also to and obviously students, but also maybe targeted to what you'd call concerned citizens, because I believe that if I'm focusing on the public as a potentially strong actor that has been missing in the case of the US and elsewhere on policy decision making on saving the lives of millions, then these people should be able to read and benefit from the findings of the book. So in terms of the audience, I would feel really good if all of these types of audiences would be be reading the book. In terms of surprises, I think it's more. I wouldn't call it a surprise, but the fact that there's so many assumptions, and I think I've mentioned that already, at the level of the genocide label, at the level of the public, that we as scholars kind of let aside or don't spend as much time researching, I guess you could call it why is a surprise in the sense of why is that not taking more. Or more center stage at genocide studies that has been branching to so many directions. So I guess the book is a call for a more systematic research into foreign policy making, because we are used to focus on international settings, on the UN where decisions are being made, but these decisions are being made based on negotiation between dominant countries, and the policies of these dominant countries are taking place domestically. And so domestically, these governments are exposed to a much greater level to pressures from the media and from the public and from NGOs. So I would like it to be such that we focus more on foreign policy making as a way to change what is happening internationally.
Great. Yes. Thank you. Just a quick note on the book. I definitely found it very accessible and to a broader audience. So hopefully you'll get the variety of readership that you're looking for. Well, Eyal, we've taken up a lot of your time. And I know that you just have a brand new book out, but I was wondering before we let you go, if there's anything you might want to tell our audience about that you're working on currently.
Yes, I have two projects. One of them relates or is a continuation of the research in the book, because I mentioned that the public is being swayed by purposeful framing of information. And I think information is a critical point. And I've found that in my research that NGOs throughout these, the 1990s and Darfur and so on, had the right early warning. They had the right risk analysis, and they had often very strong and important policy proposals or recommendations to make, but their voices are often not heard. They're not heard by the policymakers. They're not heard by the public, and are not covered well enough by the media. So one of the things that my group or members of my groups are working on is to develop intergovernmental collaborations on making stronger stand at international fora to push for stronger preventative action. But another one is to convince the NGOs, the human rights NGOs, to work more collaboratively to making their voices heard through the media, by the public and by even policymakers, to make a big difference. So that's one project that I'm thinking of working on, both at the level of research and then at the level of how to implement that into a more effective dynamics or flow of information, if you like. Another is I'm really concerned about national populism and how discrimination, racism, xenophobia are taking hold in our midst. And I find very important, again, correlations between the effects of fear that is both affecting how we react or not to mass atrocities and how we react or not to these what I see as negative forces amongst us. So I'm looking at the issues, and I would like to research more about ideas such as white genocide, the conspiracy theory that white genocide is, and how to make the link between neglecting faraway conflicts in other countries where hundreds of thousands are being killed and that we gotten so accustomed to being bystanders of, and the fact that all of a sudden we are so concerned and see ourselves as potential victims when mass refugee flows are at our doorsteps, or when international terrorism is risking or at least sowing fear in our midst, and so making that connection and trying to maybe change the cost-benefit analysis of governments and the international community as a whole in favor of more prevention and more stronger action. So these are my two projects that I'm thinking of working on or started working on.
Thank you for sharing. It's such important work bridging the gap between scholarship and policy outcomes. So thank you for your work, and thank you for your time. It was great chatting with you about your new book and other things. And thank you, and take care, and have a good night or a good day.
Thanks so much. Thanks so much for inviting me, Jeff.